Session number 10661, Reel 2.
Mr. Armandias, Reel 2. Can you tell me about Cable's personality, yes, or any stories about him that you recollect?
Yes. Well, Cable was, I think he started working in the post office. And then he met somebody, and I've got some documentation on that, who pushed him ahead, and he joined the Air Force as a cadet, I think. And he was the head, really, of the squadron on the first R4 helicopters. And he was an extraordinarily interesting fellow. And we did quite a lot together. And it is with him that one day we very nearly landed at Windsor Castle, hence the famous letter from the Queen Mother, wrote to me, because the royal family then had never seen a helicopter, and we arrived on the scene, and she remembers it because it was the first helicopter she'd seen in her life.
This was in 1944.
That was 1944, yes. And but Cable was asked to test a very odd helicopter built in England by... Now, who did build that? Anyhow, it had three rotors, and it had a Rolls-Royce engine, and Cable was conducting the test of that new helicopter with a fellow called Marsh. And unfortunately, they had a mechanical failure, and they were killed in the crash. They were burned to death. It was rather tragic, because when I was in the squadron and flying with Cable almost every day, he had a girlfriend who was the widow of a Polish fighter pilot who'd been burned to death. And she had a baby. She was the girlfriend of Cable. And obviously they were going to get married. But then Cable was burned to death too. So the poor woman had two husbands, or one husband and one boyfriend, in quick succession, both burned to death. And I've tried to keep in touch with her, but I've lost touch completely with her, and I don't know what's happened to her or the baby, unfortunately.
Can you tell me about these early helicopters? They must have been extraordinary compared with what we're used to today.
Well, Igor Sikorsky, who designed in Imperial Russia, very large aeroplanes, emigrated to America, and he built the first real possible helicopter in America. And the prototype was a very shaky affair, but the first one that was supposed to be possible was the Sikorsky R4. It was a very small helicopter, two-seater, with a Warner Scarab engine, and the lifting capacity were minimal, because, by example, on a very warm day without a wind, you couldn't take off if both of you were reasonably hefty, and you had to take off flying backwards, because really, this helicopter, when you saw an R4 flying, it was really hovering. When you saw him hovering, it was really flying in the wind. Without the wind, you couldn't... So the idea of Air Marshal Freeman, what are we going to do with these helicopters in the war? The squadron was a scientific squadron, and our job was to assess the possibility of this. And we had a lovely time flying everywhere. I could take a helicopter and go anywhere I wanted without flight plans or anything. And it was rather curious because I was technically a civilian flying a military helicopter. That's why we didn't land in the park at Windsor, because I felt we felt that if we landed there with George VI, the Queen and everything, we'd probably all be court-martialed and sent to the Tower. So we went on with these helicopters and learned an enormous amount, which was very beneficial for Hafner at Bristol for producing the first British helicopter. But as far as doing anything else with the R4, there is one R4 that I flew in the museum at Hendon now. And I went to see it some years ago, and I thought, my God, we were very lucky. Nobody really got killed with these helicopters. What happened really is that the Air Ministry sent a fellow called Brie, who died only very recently at 90, Brie and two other pilots to America to learn to fly the R4 in America. And they came back with four R4 to England and taught Cable and the others here, and Cable taught us. So, you know, it was growing that way.
What was the main problem in flying them?
Well, they were so underpowered that you couldn't lift anything. I mean, you literally couldn't carry anything at all.
How controllable were they?
Well, they were very bad, very bad indeed. I mean, you really had to use both your hands, both your feet, and both your knees to keep the thing going. I'll show you some photos, actually. I got some photos there.
But did you witness any accidents?
Well, I fell through the cushion myself once. Because, you see, on modern helicopters, if you've got the blades, which have got quite good momentum, the blades we had were wooden blades covered in fabric, and therefore the momentum was practically nil. If the engine stopped, you had 3 seconds to go from helicoptering pitch to autogyrating pitch, and you could land with a dead engine if you managed to get enough space below you, because it took about 800 feet to switch from the one to the other. But if you didn't do what you had to do within 3 seconds, you were sitting on a pile of of junk. But fortunately, these engines were absolutely marvelous. As far as I'm concerned, I can't think of anybody who got caught with a dead engine. But we had to qualify. You had to do one landing with a dead engine, i.e. having done the necessary thing to go from helicoptering pitch to autogyrating pitch. And that was pretty frightening. And now, days on modern helicopters in the Air Force, they don't do the test anymore because it's too dangerous. And in any case, now you've got turbines, you've got multiple rotors, and you've got a lot more momentum in the blade. They're much heavier, and therefore, before the rotor stops, you've got perhaps 10 seconds or more. But in those days, these helicopters were just the first possible ones.
Was there much competition between the RAF and the Fleet Air Arm and the other parties involved as to who should get them?
Well, no, because the squadron was the scientific squadron, and you had Air Force, Cable was Air Force, SOX was Navy, there was another fellow, Fleet Air Arm, I can't remember, and there was a fellow from the Army, and there was Liptot and myself. So we were all doing the same thing, sorting out what could be done, and eventually it could have been decided who was going to get them or what, but there was no competition at all. We were all... I've been reminded recently that I was the only one then who had a very small German car, a DKW, and I was rather popular, although I'd forgotten all about this, because I could carry the chaps to the pub or something like this. I'd forgotten all about it. And I found a photo recently of that little car. So we were mainly at Bewley and Feltham. Feltham was a small little airport, which is now disappeared in the middle of the London airport. And then we were flying every day there when they were making the longest runway and what four bombers, which eventually became the basis of the London airport. So we used to fly every morning, watching the people building that long runway. And the London airport didn't exist then. I mean, there's nothing. And Feltham has disappeared.
What other types of helicopter came after the R-4?
Well, the Americans went on at Sikorsky and made the R-6 and everything, but we didn't get them here. Hafner at Bristol produced the first two British helicopters, which were used by the RAF. One was called the 175, I think, and the other one was the Belvedere. But if you are interested in that, the fellow who's done everything for helicopters in England is Horsgood, who's still about. Although he has a lot of trouble, with, like me, with arthritis and everything, but he's still there. And after he left Bristol, he joined the electricity company and he formed a team using helicopters to check on the lines. But he had an unfortunate... he had to retire because he had a loss of memory one day and he lost his license. And he's now retired and he spends his time playing golf and so forth. But he did a marvelous job. If Cable had lived, he also would have done a marvelous job. But unfortunately, he died in that crash. Now, I can't remember really just now if what I did in 1944 when I used French uniform and another name and went on the continent of Europe was before my helicopter interlude or after. I just can't remember. Unfortunately, I lost all my diaries during the war. And because when I was at Warrington, I used to, as you know, Warrington, my co-director, Owen, used to stay in the Patton Arms at Warrington, which was a glorified, it was really nasty hotel. And I said to him, well, if I'm going to be killed, I'm not going to be killed in that place. I just don't like it. I go to the Adelphi. Well, the Adelphi in... So I used to commute between Warrington and Liverpool, and I was caught in one or two air raids. And in 42, we had a very bad week at Liverpool when they bombed us, really. And I was in my room in the hotel and wondering what to do next because I could hear the bombs falling down. And eventually, a landmine fell outside my bedroom. And as you know, with a landmine, you can't hear it because it comes down with a parachute. And it killed the people next door to me. And... I got away with it, but it shook me rather badly, and a week after, I lost all my hair and had a duodenum ulcer. But that week in Liverpool was a bad week. Very bad indeed.
You went across to Normandy at the time...
I landed back in France on the 4th of November, 44. In French uniform, because I was really then doing liaison between British intelligence and French intelligence. And I think I'll tell you more after, so that you decide if you wanted it on the record or not.
Let's leave the question of your intelligence activities for the moment. Right. Let me go back to the early part of your career, because you mentioned Sir Frederick Handley Page. Can you tell me what memories you have of him personally?
Yes, he was an extraordinary fellow. I mean, he used to call me at any time, and we had a very good relationship, but he was a complete autocrat. And in fact, the end of Handley Page, when he refused to see the world as it was and to merge with other people and everything. And... he was really, well, he was the same sort of like the Sopwiths of these days. I mean, I was the second generation. The people like the Handley Page, the Hawkers, and the Vickers and everything were the first generation. Handley Page was larger than life. I used to give him dinners and take him to Paris and everything. And he was very, very keen that the Halifax should be fitted with high-pressure hydraulic, because the Halifax, with a high-pressure system, had one great advantage over the Stirling or the Lancaster, is that the equipment for high pressures was lighter, and therefore it could take one more bomb, everything being equal, than the other system. And now all aeroplanes use high-pressure hydraulics, and not only 4,000 pounds, but much, much higher. But we were the first one. I did not invent high-pressure hydraulics, but I brought it to England. Before that, everybody was operating at low pressures, heavy equipment. We brought light equipment, high pressures. And that's what Handley Page were interested in. And Volkert was a very interesting fellow, and he backed me to the hill, and the ministry backed me to the hill. I mean, it took me between the moment I came back to England to introduce high-pressure hydraulics and the Messier system, it took me something like 4 years to get going. And at one stage, I really had no money to go on at all. And after the war, I appeared for the French. I was the first one to appear on the Royal Commission of Awards to Inventors. And we had a full hearing. I stayed a month in front of them. I got £120,000 subject to tax for the French company, which was a lot of money. Whittle got £100,000 free of tax, but Whittle was a different case. He was a serving officer in the RAF and had taken all his patents and everything and given it to America, and they had to reward him. I can tell you more about this, but I don't think what I'm going to tell you should be put on tape either.
Did you see the first flight of the Halifax?
Yes.
Can you describe it?
The first... I'd like to refresh my memory with either Conway or Orloff, because as I was I started as technical director and I became the managing director. So when you become managing director, you lose touch with the details, and therefore I wasn't always there, because it is, I had all sorts of keep the liaison with the ministry and everything. And the first flight took place at, I can't even remember the name now. I flew in the Halifax, in the prototype as well, but not on the first flight. And the man who was piloting the first one was Major Cords, an extraordinary fellow. He always wore a monocle. He had a handlebar moustache. And eventually he flew helicopters too in the end. The Halifax was a very good... And what that fellow has written in this book is really very interesting. He's done quite a lot of work.
We're talking about Victor Bingham's, yes, Halifax. Yes,
the only thing is that I only wish he could have told me a bit more before publishing it, that's all. He's got certain facts wrong, but by and large, it's a very interesting book.
Are there any facts that you want to correct now, that he says?
I don't think they're worth correcting, really. I think it's... You see, there are various people since the war who haven't been into the war, and if they have, like the fellow West, by example, whom I know, who came to see me here. West is a fellow who's an MP now, called Allison. Well, he told me that what he did is better than work. And he went to all the various places where there are official documents, and he's been going like a rat through all this and getting all sorts of facts. which are fascinating. And then if you have got the ability of writing a book, then here you are, you're in business.
Can we go on to the canon trials?
Yes. Well, yes, all right. So we got... Am I on the thing? Yes. Well, so... I had forgotten most of this, and that's when I wrote to Farnborough if they could give me the date of all this, and they sent me all these details. And what happened is that we got a 510 de Wettin fighter from France, and I've discovered in what Farnborough sent me that eventually the British government bought it. So we were, as far as Messier, we were making the controls for firing the cannon. And Prince Poniatowski then had asked me if I would leave Messier and go to Grantham to become the managing director of the Hispano cannon at Grantham. I didn't want to do that for two reasons. First of all, I was interested in what I was doing, and I've never wanted to be mixed up with armament as such. In fact, I had the opportunity of getting that machine gun from America, what is it called? And I didn't want to do it because I didn't mind doing all the equipment for helping, but I didn't want to be an armament man. I didn't want that. So we got that De Wettin fighter, and I went to Martlesham Heath, and there was a very big galaxy of air marshals and everything. We fired that cannon, and nobody was interested. It just petered out. And I was very, very upset about it because I felt that, you know, the Germans had cannons, and there was an enormous advantage, and we could have had cannon. That's the sort of thing, when I write to Keegan, I'm not saying that we were not prepared for passive defense and everything, but to say that we won the war because we were very well prepared. As far as I'm concerned, no, I don't agree with that. And if you read the finest hour of Martin Gilbert and Churchill during those years, my God, we had a very narrow squeak.
You're referring there to your correspondence with John Gilbert, yes. John Keegan,
I've got it there, I'll show it to you.
Made a claim that Britain was well prepared for the Second World War, and you're pointing out to him.
Well, I mean, to write an article saying we won the war because we were, I think he used the word exceedingly well prepared, in my opinion, is a travesty of the facts.
In fact, the RAF did, a bit later in the war, start to use cannons.
Yeah, yes. With cannons made in England at Grantham, were then the Hispano cannon. And there is a fascinating book written by... my memory is so bad now. I've got it there. I'll tell you who wrote that book because there's two paragraphs in that book were absolutely fascinating.
When the German air attacks came on Britain in 1940, how crucial would it have been to the success of their war effort if they'd have bombed your plant in Warrington?
Well, in my opinion, when they obviously decided to bomb Bristol's, Vickers, Rolls-Royce and everything, they made an enormous mistake because had the intelligence of bombing two plants, one which would be Robreau and Messier in Warrington and Doughty in Cheltenham, they would have stopped the whole of the undercarriage and hydraulic program. And had they done that, you can move a fighter, but pushing a four-engine bomber out of a factory is another matter. And every night I thought, well, if they bomb the right place, that's it.
You were telling me earlier about an experience you had at the time of the evacuation of soldiers from France,
right,
in which you saved this country quite a lot of money.
Yes.
I wonder if you could repeat what you were telling me there.
Yes. At the time of the fall of France, quite a lot of people, mainly armed forces, escaped from France on all sorts of ships of every size and configuration and everything, and arrived mainly in the roads outside Liverpool. And the authorities then were very pushed, and they felt that allowing these ships to come in Liverpool might be dangerous. Who knows who was on board? And therefore, they had to anchor outside Liverpool in what they called the roads. But a lot of the personnel went ashore, and the military personnel, most of them were in tents in one of the parks at Liverpool, and they stayed there for quite some time before the authorities could decide what was going to be done about them. And Spears, who was General Spears, was sent by Churchill to talk to them. Unfortunately, I don't think that he hit quite the right note. And after his departure, the French who were there felt that they hadn't got enough to eat. They killed all the swans and ate them, which created absolute mayhem in Liverpool. It so happened that in the middle of the naval personnel, I had a friend, Guy de Choqueuse, who had been at school with me in Paris, had been sunk and remained in the sea for quite a long time and contracted TB. I met him and we had various conversations together, and in the end he decided to go back to France with those who did decide not to join the Free French and wanted to be repatriated. But one day he told me that the personnel left on board the ships were getting fed up, and that night they were going to open the cocks and get the whole thing down to the bottom. I contacted my friend Bruce Hutley at intelligence, and I can't remember now what exactly they did, but they stopped the crew opening the cocks. And I gaily said after that, "What about my salvage reward?" Which, needless to say, I never pressed and never got. But I'm quite satisfied that had the thing gone down to the bottom,